Hello, my name is Lorraine Ferranti. I am 53 years old. Today is March 23rd, 2006, and we are in Flagstaff, Arizona. And I am interviewing Dr. Frederick Bernard Wood.
Okay. My name is Frederick Bernard Wood. I am 88 years old. The date is March 23rd, 2006. The location is Flagstaff, Arizona. And the person who's questioning me is my nurse.
Okay, so Fred, hi. So can you tell us where you were born?
I was born in Sacramento, California in 1917.
And can you tell me something that stands out in your mind during this time in 1917?
Okay, I remember that somewhere along the 9 months after I was conceived in my mother's uterus, I began to have a greater awareness of what was going on around me. I just hear words and understand, and after a while, a few months, I learned about what some of the words meant. So you hear my mother and father talking, you hear friends of my mother coming and talking, so that I was aware of what was going on. And my mother had been working as a political activist for the Socialist Party in the USA. My father, her husband, was a leader in the California Republican Party. He told her she had to stop making public statements about socialism, but my dad okayed her to participate in prayer meetings in churches. So she embarked on leading prayer meetings in churches, and because I was in the uterus hearing these, and gradually I caught on to what they were about. And also, she took me each Sunday morning to a church, and I heard the sermons. Now, I heard the sermon, the ministers, somewhere in each sermon, he would say, "We must learn how to make better communication to our brains and our soul," but he did not define what the soul was. But so I began wondering, what is that?
That's very interesting. And at that time, there were real no credible sources to substantiate this phenomena of memory in the womb. Is that correct?
That's right. And but recently, in the last year, there have been several articles in scientific journals and religious journals about this question. So there's an organization known as the Institute of Ionic...
Institute of Noetic Sciences.
In Petaluma, California. And they recently published two articles, one by Richard Heinberg on creativity begins in the womb, and an associate of his, Wendy Ann McCarty, has published an article on nurturing the possible. Now, when I saw that, I really jumped with happiness, because for 88 years, people have been shouting me down and saying, "You can't prove that. We have no evidence that the fetus can understand anything." See,
so do you feel that this is, while your mother worked as a political activist for the Socialist Party, is this where you gained your desire to learn more about?
Yeah. So now, okay. So over the years, I've had a considerable amount of research on this, and how, when I was 3 days old, I lost the ability of my brain to communicate with my soul. So I thought, well, what happened? Then I remembered, 2 days after I was born, I was circumcised. I figured that must have cut off the nerves that provided the connection between the brain and the soul, but I couldn't figure out how that worked. So I thought about that for many years, and but I discovered that there were a lot of other children, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, who were upset that the adults didn't believe them about things like that. And the doctor said I and these other children would die by age 6 if we didn't come down and we would stop being upset over our failure to communicate with the adults. See? So
so today there are many doctors and scholars who openly oppose circumcision.
Yeah.
Is that part of your belief system here?
Yes, in my belief system, I believe, contrary to the anatomy books that show one main nerve coming from the brain that spreads out to the different organs of the body, that there are three communication channels. There's this one nerve that they find when they perform an autopsy, but there's a torsion waves of electric waves that circle around the outer, one torsion wave going this way and the other torsion going this way. So there's essentially three communication channels connecting the brain to the rest of the body. But I can't prove that, but I've just recently got those articles I mentioned of the Institute of Genetic Sciences that they believe that may be correct.
And I see you have some documentation on how you feel that this is one of the major contributors of the collapse of our civilization. Yeah. Can you elaborate a little
yes.
on that?
Yes, okay. Our genetic code apparently sets up the conditions by which we got the nerves from the brain with three channels, and they're designed so that with the two extra channels they can transmit, one takes information to the quantum vacuum, another brings it back to the brain, and other people are doing it so that the quantum vacuum can integrate what's the statistical distribution of people's feelings about ethics, so the individual knows what the average trend of other people is, and he can decide whether he wants to agree with them or not, or push it the other way or something. So that, the circumcision cuts off those two extra channels. So now, and the apparent reason for that is that historically, that I looked into the history of the 19 previous major civilizations in the last 6,000 years, and I found that there was an institute in London that studied those for many years, and they confirmed that all these civilizations, all except one, Egypt, never survived more than one cycle of rise and fall. Because they didn't know about the third order electromagnetic waves, that when they perform an autopsy, they'd find the residue of the main nerve, which is only a one-way channel, and so they didn't understand how conscience was developed. They saw it now.
So can we go a little backwards in time now? Can you talk a little bit about how you served in the war?
Yes, okay.
In the 40s?
Oh, okay. I served in an unusual way. I had a job at the Berkeley Radiation Laboratory as a technician. This is before I got my bachelor's degree. And one day I was preparing some samples of rare gases. I won't go into the details of them, but and I knew there might be dangerous, so I carefully separated them and only had small quantities, but I didn't do it carefully enough, and they blew up and burnt down the end of the cyclotron building.
How did that lead to you working under house arrest?
Well, I think what it is that they just wanted to fire me, see?
Mm-hmm.
But I said, no, I've learned from this how we might develop more powerful weapons to stop Hitler from crossing the English Channel. And if you just fire me, I won't be able to work on that don't have the tools in the lab. So I went all the way up to command in the Army. All of them said no. So I went to the War Department in Washington, D.C., and I got an assistant secretary of war. He said, let me think about it. And he called me back a couple of days. He said, maybe you do have a good point here, but would you be willing to work for a year under house arrest, which does not require that you have top secret clearance because you're under the supervision of Army guards? So I said, okay, I'll go on that. And
This where you worked on the Signal Corps model, the SCR 584 radar?
That's right. They'd already designed it before I came on the scene. Yeah, okay.
Well, just tell us a little bit from
your
memory.
The wrong stuff there.
Well, okay.
That's not the right stuff.
Okay. You were just saying that you estimated that the German electrical engineers had the capacity of developing new weapons.
Yeah, see, what I said it down here. Okay, yeah, okay. Okay, so I went full speed ahead and got a cooperation while working under house arrest to redesign the 721A electronic tube that would work faster than previous ones so that the 584 radar could be focused on objects much more quickly than previously. And so we stopped the first three attempts of Hitler crossing the channel, but our intelligence agents said they're going to try a fourth attempt and they may be able to develop a more powerful weapon that we can't stop. So we had changed tactics. So I said, let's do the following. Let's use this improved radar system to secretly measure and observe how they're building their launching pads so that we would know how they function, and then try to find out when they were getting ready to launch them, and the day before, blow up the launching pads. And that worked. And it was going to take them 6 months to rebuild the launching pad. So Hitler gave up crossing the English Channel and went off in a different direction, see. So we...
You were successful.
We were successful. Even though I was working under military house arrest. So then they canceled the military house arrest and gave me top secret clearance to continue on further things. So that... So that time, now.
And what year did you get married?
Okay, just before that, I want to say that it's an important thing to develop. Some years later, a Dr. Papp from Hungary came to Canada, the United States. His name's Papp. He somehow picked up on those rare elements that blew up in my lab before I had enough knowledge what was going on. He said, well, that in itself is another potential energy source. So he designed a modified automobile engine run on those gases and demonstrated it would work. But some of the top physicists in the country didn't believe him. So some years later, the government set out a test to see whether Papp's machine would work. And I got to watch the tests in Campbell, California, in a secret warehouse, and show that it did work. But then they moved the equipment down to Gardena, California, near Los Angeles, and it blew up and killed one government official and seriously injured a couple of others. So the government decided that would not work. But then they had a secret investigation. They classified all this as top secret. They found that one of the top physicists at Caltech sabotaged the equipment. He came in at midnight before the day of the test and cut some of the wires that had the safety control circuits to make it safe.
Okay. All right. And
was that signal time?
No. And there are some details on the Papp machine referenced in the Atlas Rising. Is that correct?
Yeah. In the magazine, right. Atlas Rising. And
okay, let's talk a little bit about
Okay.
You got married in 1942.
Okay, and you got married in 1942, had two sons, one born in 1945, his name was Fred, and the other, Peter, was born in 1948.
And you were married for 40 years.
Yeah, okay.
And during this time, you worked for IBM.
Yeah, okay. Now, but every year I got in a, for 27 years, I worked for IBM, and every year I got in a conflict with top IBM management, see. I considered my job was do research on how IBM equipment gave us aids in understanding environmental problems and gave us aids in how we could do about it. But the oil industry didn't like my work because, so IBM officials tried to get rid of me, but I convinced them not to fire me. And then I discovered that pretty soon the presidents of the top three oil companies got themselves on the board of directors of IBM, so they tried to fire me. And I was sitting arguing them down, and but I got demoted and got paid less pay at IBM. But anyway, so
what was some of the substantial or the significant experiences that you had when you worked with your years at IBM?
Yeah. Okay. See, at IBM, I worked on developing new types of computer memories that made computers more efficient. So, I haven't covered the McCarthy clause. That comes up next. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, but you mentioned in your documents here that you that the management was hostile towards you because of the ethical views that you had.
Yeah, and they said engineers aren't supposed to have any ethics.
And about IBM being associated with the Hitler.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit
about that? Okay, so now I discovered that my Jewish neighbors began to get hostile toward me when they learned I worked for IBM. So I finally got someone to tell me why. They looked at our files and our newspaper pictures showing Hitler and T.J. Watson, the president of IBM, conferring about IBM providing the computers to make the killing of the Jews more efficient. And so as IBM gained considerable investment money from the Nazis to develop their computer systems for speeding up the killing off of most of the Jews in Europe. Now, the history of that is, I found it very interesting that in the last 6,000 years, the Jews became slaves in turn of each major country. They built the monuments for them, the great temples, roads, aqueducts, and so on, so that the Jews provided important service. So the previous countries, although they kept the Jews as slaves, they wanted to keep them working. They didn't want to kill them off, see? But here's what happened. One of the professors, who in 1917 was in jail under the possibility of being executed for not supporting the communist revolution, made a study of the rate of new inventions per year the last 6,000 years. So I compared that with all the other things happening. The reason the Jews, Hitler wanted to execute, he said, we don't need the prisoners anymore because we've got new inventions that can replace the prisoners. So well, we don't want to have to feed all these 6 million Jews in Europe, so let's kill them off. See? So,
so I'm going to kind of
move
you on a little bit here. I understand that you were involved with resisting the efforts of the Un-American Activity Committee to suppress the public discussion of many political interests, namely the McCarthy investigation. Can you?
Yeah, okay. In 1954, 2 years after I was started working at IBM, I was the treasurer of the San Jose Unitarian Church, and the McCarthy Committee was investigating churches to see if there were any communists in the churches. and they pinwheeled me. They thought I had communist ideas. So they asked IBM to fire me, and they stirred up trouble in the Unitarian Church. I got elected to be treasurer by something like 25 to 23 votes were in favor of me being treasurer. And so with the McCarthy Committee getting people upset, reversed that so that they now had 23 people in favor of me and 25 against me. And they asked me to resign. I said, no, I have a few more months. I just won't run for re-election as treasurer. So in those 2 or 3 months, I started organizing a brief for a lawsuit against McCarthy, and I had to take a leave of absence a few months from IBM to study law to do that. But I,
you were successful, though.
I got the brief prepared in 1955, and it took 3 years to get up to the Supreme Court, and they decided in my favor. But I didn't get hardly any of my expenses, legal expenses, back. The churches took all the money. But I said, I'm not going to stir up trouble with them. So
you got your doctorate in 1953?
Yes, and I had another problem then. We had a rumor that there were 4 of us candidates were going to be failed by the committee on the qualifying exams for mathematics for getting a PhD in physics. So we went to the chancellor of the university, and he said, you haven't presented me any evidence, just a rumor, but where there's a rumor, I can suspend the professor for 24 hours to give him a chance to look into the matter, see? And if you can get your exam given in that 24-hour time, you may get your PhDs all right, see? And so you're doing that. What happened was that the morning of the exam, we were there, and here was the professors who were going to fail us. But in a few minutes, the chairman of the department came and asked them what questions they were prepared to ask. And see, they prepare a written list of the questions. So he looked at me and said, those are rigged questions. So I asked the chairman of this committee to leave the campus for 24 hours, and I will take over giving the exam, see? Okay, so that's the way I got my PhD. So next you have, what's your next?
I know you want to go, there's a little bit more involvement with that particular topic, but I just want to know, more interestingly, is what was your involvement with the development of the systems theory?
Okay. In parallel with my formal studies at the University of California, I did 2 things. One, I studied what was going on in Vienna, Austria. There was a group forming a unified science program where they would piece together the parts of the different sciences and see how they fit together in a unified whole. And second, I attended the seminars at the University YWCA on what was going on in the social sciences. So I put the 2 things together and wanted to form what they call the International Society for the General Systems Theory, but the IRS ruled that that was a political organization, it wouldn't be qualified. But the vice president of IBM helped us reword the naming and the write the different constitution, which was accepted. And in fact, it had the backing of IBM. The IRS accepted that, where they thought a bunch of communists maybe they wouldn't accept it. See, so we got, now this organization is going to celebrate their 50th anniversary this coming July at a meeting in Sonoma, California. I don't know whether I'm in good enough shape to travel.
That's this year, huh? July of 2006.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that now.
Well, I wanted to ask you now, you talked a little bit about the suppression. Well, we didn't talk really about Maxwell's theory because they're going to cut us 6 minutes, but we'll see if we can add it at the end. But just all of your involvement with the loyalty oath and the collaboration with the development systems theory, how would you sum up your life's work?
Okay. I say my first major advance was in 1971, where I realized that the suppression of the real meaning of electromagnetic theory and other related things was giving a distorted view of the anatomy that emitted the two communication channels. And so I prepared a one-page summary of the history of these past 21 civilizations. We showed it all, but the Egyptian civilization survived two cycles, the rest only one. And all of them were highly dependent on the Jewish slaves to do their real work for them, see? So the Jews must know something that other people don't know. And I began doing search on that, and I found the Jews had,
I know that you had written a paper using the systems theory.
Yes, anyway, and I distributed this paper, and most people didn't understand it, but anyway, but I found that the Jewish scientists were more likely to understand it, so I figured, what do they know that the rest of people don't know? And I found that the patriarch Abraham, almost 6,000 years ago, leader of the Jews, negotiated the conditions under which the Jews would agree not to revolt against being made slaves by the Babylonians. They had worked 6 days a week, no work on Sunday, either for their church services and philosophical research, see. And they figured out a diagram called the Holy Sephirot, which showed the relationship of about 10 different fields in human activity, which enabled the Jews to advance much more rapidly in understanding society. Okay.
Did you include that in the paper you wrote in 1971?
No, I didn't. In 1971, I just included the rise and fall.
That's when you did some research.
And I found what caused the Egyptians to go two cycles is the fall of the first cycle was partly sociological and partly geophysical. There was a big flood, and a lot of the Egyptians head for the hills. Higher elevation.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you prepared a one-page summary in graphic form to illustrate the major conclusions of the historians.
Most people were horrified. This committee that did the real search had 11 volumes of the study, and I thought nobody's going to read those 11 volumes. So I got the 11 volumes and studied it carefully. Then they'd read every word. So I prepared this one-page summary, and I convinced a lot of people that it was important to study this, see. So, but most universities didn't like my theory because I was breaking down the barriers between the different fields. Okay. So this led to my developing a theory of possible, we call it a circuit diagram of how the brain, through the nerves that go through the genital area, connection with vortexes and interaction with chakras, to be able to transformation back and forth between the brain and the soul. But most scientists said, but you can't prove it. Well, I said, look, about the chakras, I can put my fingers on my head in the places where I'm supposed to be different chakras and feel some kind of vibrations. That's not a scientific measurement, but it shows there's something going on there, see. So I kept on startling on these. And
so by using the systems theory, it seems like you're trying to establish a more scientific basis.
Yes.
On how to scientifically analyze.
Yeah, yes. And then I wondered, why is there no progress on acceptance?
And you went on here to say the differential equations of electricity and magnetism and the soul and religion.
Okay. What I found is that there was a group known as the henchmen of the ruling class, who was a secret organization that looked for people like me, and under the rules, they had to first give me a warning. That's 10 minutes. Okay. That I might get.
Why don't we talk just really quickly what brought you to Flagstaff, Arizona?
Yeah, okay. I wanted to pick a place that was free from being flooded by a tsunami and was relatively free of earthquakes and other geophysical problems, see? So that I came here to be free from the physical problem, but that didn't keep the henchman ruling class from coming by or finding who was here. So I bet, yeah. Okay. And then there's also Planet X coming by that our government tried to suppress.
Okay, so you came here to be safe from Planet X and to be on the Colorado Plateau.
Yes.
Okay, so what do you foresee for the future of our civilization, to kind of close things up in summary?
Okay, what I see is that I have to look back over the history of systems theory and find out what are we missing. And I found certain techniques that are missing that. But the two things we have to achieve is, one, we have to develop an understanding of the relationship of the soul and the third order electromagnetic field. And second, we must develop what I call the ODF matrix of the world economic system that leads to discussions consistent with policies that are consistent with scientific knowledge of how our planet works. So we got two major projects. Now, I'm working on one, and Lester Brown is working on the second part of the problem. He just published a book. It's called something like World Plan Version B2.0 he had a book a few years ago, and he's modified that, and he's learned more. So I'm not concentrating on the economic problem, but I'm covering on what's the block is. And I discovered that back in 1969, two professors, Clark and Clark, Connecticut State University, figured a way to look at that part of the problem, but it got neglected somewhere along the way. Oh, see, I had a stroke in 1999 that partly curtailed my activities for a while, and I'm gradually recovering from it. Enough to be active again. But what they call their approach, the crescent approach to studying these problems, where they draw a crescent. The upper part of the crescent are the things that help us solve the problems, and the lower part of the crescent are the things that retard us. So the henchmen of the ruling class work in the lower part and try to sabotage the work of us working in the upper part. So we haven't been very conscious of that opposition of the henchmen of the ruling class, but I now am. But several of us have been killed by the henchmen of the ruling class because we said too much. So, now, one thing I'm pleased with, in the second part of the problem, Lester Brown has got 500 people supporting his work. So the Hedgeman Rowing Class got 500 people to knock off before they stop his part. So I have to figure out, how do I get 500 people working on my part of the problem in order to stop them from knocking us out, see? And I run the risk, if they catch on to what I'm doing too early, they may bump me off and my word might not get around. So I'm pleased to have the opportunity to present these ideas at this interview so a little more people can know what I'm working on.
I know that you have tried to get other organizations involved in helping them to understand.
But most of them get scared and retreat, see? But I feel we're at a time where we can move forward more rapidly. Okay.
And here you said that we must develop a, and I'm not quite sure what that
That's
is.
That's the Leonov matrix. It is a matrix about 70 columns and 70 rows, with the each little square in it is one section of the economy. It shows what the mining industry contributes to the automobile manufacturing and what the oil industry contributes to other things and so on. So there's an interconnection between the different industries. So you look at this and see what industries do we need to develop to get a more forward efficient economic system. See, the oil industry controls the whole economic system under capitalism. So if they go maximize the profits of the oil industry, and we need to figure out what balance gives the balanced improvement of all the industries. See? Okay, yeah.
And so that would help with the world economic system.
Yes, and okay, there have been patents that have been suppressed for 100 years. It would help us do that if we get better organized, because there's what's known as the MEG electric generator that was invented 100 years ago, 102 years ago, by Nikola Tesla. But the stockbrokers pushed his company into bankruptcy so he couldn't develop it because it was not consistent with maximizing the oil industry's profits, but for maximizing the total benefits to all the people of the world. And, but there's a group of 5 Army officers, most of them retired now, who worked on the development of that, that they own the basic patent on the MEG machine, and they will not sell it to anybody. They will offer to sell a non-exclusive license to anyone who shows the capability of building them, but nobody will build it without getting an exclusive license, so they don't get built. And I can see why. Those officers feel that the lawyers for any company getting exclusive license will just stop, block the production of this improved source of electric power.
Well, it seems like you certainly have a lot of knowledge to yes. share with us.
Yes.
There is one thing that we didn't discuss at all, which was Maxwell's equation. Can you briefly talk a little bit about how you were introduced to Maxwell's equation and your involvement with that?
Yes, okay. Okay, the way Maxwell's equations are set of solutions of the differential equations for electricity and magnetism. That if you find all the roots, you have a list of different types of electric waves that can be generated from electricity and magnetism. But our society for 100 years has concentrated on doing one of the solutions only, the one that makes the most money to the people who invest money in it, see, rather than getting the most benefits to the people of the world. So I need to educate people like the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom enough of physics to understand how they can be more powerful in working for peace and freedom by pushing the right inventions that would bring electricity cheaper to everyone in the world, so there's no shortage of electricity that caused the different nations to fight for the electric power generating stations, but they can all get their share.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you've certainly made a lot of contributions in your lifetime. Is there any last minute words that you'd like to share with us?
Okay, I'd say that we've got clues of methods that help us solve the analysis of why our country is not moving along in these, but we have to do it carefully so as to not get killed off before we get a report out on it. See? So we have to balance how much we tell people at this stage before making a strong campaign and get our leaders killed by the henchmen of the ruling class. See? Now, see, I don't believe that the top executives of the oil companies understand what their henchmen working for are doing, see. They just tell someone, hire the henchmen to stop the development of certain things. They don't know that they're really murdering the inventors and things like that, see. So, as the next step, I'm going to list of something like 15 people that may have been killed by the henchmen of the ruling class. So if people start looking to see if they can find more evidence of what happened to them.
But ultimately, you want to see a more peaceful
world where, see, we have inventions, we have enough inventions now. So for the present population of the world, we have more than enough energy available. But if we let the population just grow and grow, we may reach another crisis later on, but I'm not trying to solve that future. I want to solve the present crisis. We're not generating enough electricity to satisfy the needs of the present world population, but we have the inventions have been developed to do that. Some of them may not be very safe to use, but we've demonstrated that we can invent control systems to control the more dangerous ones that will shut down if it gets to a dangerous state of operation. So.
Well, thank you for your contributions, okay. Dr. Fred Wood.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Did you want to say anything about your religious, the statistics you had, if you wanted to, or are you good?
Well, let's see. Oh, yeah. I'm going to get this sheet on the religion. Oh, there it is. Okay. You see, our present U.S. trained our wars, we think the Muslims are our enemy, and we're building a big army. So we invaded Iraq, who are Muslims, and we've taken over other Muslim countries. But I made this table of what are the percentage of people of different religions. 29% of the people of the world are what they call affiliated Christians. And then the Muslims are 19.9%, and the Hindus 11.3%, and they go down. The Jews are 0.2%, and the Baha'is are 0.1%. Now, I've looked into the history of the Baha'is. They came about, they were Muslims that separated from the Muslim religion. And it was in 1885, the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, which is a Muslim empire covering Turkey and related areas, asked his staff, why are we imprisoning so many people for demonstrating against the government? Well, they're just rebels. Okay, well, he said, let's change our policy. We will continue to arrest them, but give them good food and accommodations, and give them paper, pens, and ink so they can write down why they're opposing the government. Maybe they know something we don't know, see? And the Sultan learned from that that there were important reasons for all this unrest, and that part of the world under Muslim rule began to develop more orderly and have more justice among their different peoples. But we tend to forget about that. Now, to give you an idea, that was in 464 that Muhammad came out with his rule against usury. That's charging too high interest. But he didn't know how to read and write. So his ideas might have gotten lost in the world, but people in the Catholic Church and the Vatican said, we better help the guy get his ideas written and printed. So they sent a woman Catholic philosopher to join the Mohammedans' harem and help him learn to read and write. So, and that got the Quran published. It took 20 years to get the Quran published. So I got Muhammad's ideas printed. But the Christian churches accepted that rule against usury, or including compound interest there again, up to the year 1000. The Catholic Church accepted the year 1500. But since the 1500, all the Christian churches have ignored the wisdom of the Prophet Muhammad about the high interest rates and compound interest are going to cause trouble, see? So we need to do a better theoretical analysis of how it does cause the trouble. Right?
Okay. Okay, thank you, Dr. Wood.
Okay.